accession number 31392, Reel 3.
Bill Reeks, Reel 3. With this training, who were the pilots you had there? Were they specially attached to the station, or were they from an operational squadron? As you
They were a mixture. Training pilots, especially those who flew in, say, the Proctor, you didn't need to be a expert pilot, and so they recruited them from what they used to term pre-war sportsman flyers, people who already had a pilot's license. The rest of them who flew more sporty aircraft like the Albacore or the Blackburn Rock and things like that, higher performance, they were often resting operational pilots.
How long were you in Trinidad?
5 months. And it was very, very intensive. We flew 6 days a week. We had, as I mentioned before, we had a session very early in the morning and a session late morning. One of those would be a flying session and the other would be a classroom session. And we had, the weather was very, very good there, so we missed very, very little flying because of weather. We also had very, very little time off. Well, I think we only had 2 weekends in 5 months.
And what did you do with your free time?
Well, not much to do, really. You could go into Port of Spain, which was the main port there, and just enjoy yourself having a few drinks. And it was interesting to go around the local countryside as well. I did go over the mountains once, over to the other side of the island, and we did meet a few Americans at a time, because they had a big military camp there.
How did you return to the UK?
Ah, that's another long story. They put us on a ship at Port of Spain when we finished our training. It was only going to New York, so they dropped us off there. Theoretically, we were by then qualified observers, and so we were going home to be commissioned as sub-lieutenants, but we couldn't get our uniforms or do the necessary until we got to UK, because there were no facilities in Trinidad, and so we were still in our sailor suits. And by that time we had been promoted to leading naval airmen, which meant we had our killick on our arm, which was equivalent to a corporal in the army, but we still looked like sailors and we were treated as such. And so when we got to New York, we were put in Brooklyn Navy Barracks, and I was immediately given a broom and ordered to sweep out the petty officers' mess. And then they had a brilliant idea, as we were theoretically seamanship trained, which was a joke. They had some 1,500 ton landing ships with loaded up with tanks ready to cross the Atlantic. And so they thought, we're short of crews, we can split 52nd Observer's course up and send them over as ship's crew on these LSTs. And so they ordered me to go to 99 Pier, Brooklyn, report to LST 365. I went on board and I was immediately handed this peculiar thing, and I was told I was bosun's mate. And I'd never blown a bosun's whistle before, and I thought to myself, what does a bosun's mate do? And going back into my memories at St. Vincent some months before, I said, oh yes, they blow this thing and call out hands to dinner, or pipe down at night time, or rise and shine in the morning. And so I said, yes, I think I can do this job. Anyway, after a few days, fortunately, he had second thoughts and took us off and sent us back as passengers on a submarine depot ship, the HMS Wolf. And that was the only time on that vessel when we slept in our hammocks, having carried them for the best part of a year.
What's it like to sleep in a hammock?
Marvellous, because we had a gale all the way back, and the ship was rolling. It was designed to go up the St. Lawrence River, and it was fairly flat-bottomed, and so it was a very, very bad ship for rolling, and so the sleeping in a hammock was ideal.
Did you have any duties on board at all?
No, none at all. We were passengers.
Any U-boat scares at all coming back?
No, again, because I think of this stern gale all the way across, it was too rough for the U-boats, I believe, and so we were completely unscathed. Apparently the convoy before us and the convoy after us were terribly mutilated. So, again, we were very lucky.
And when was it that you got back into the UK?
This was about March 43 by this time.
What was the next stage for you? Were you commissioned at that stage?
Yeah, we were sent on a short leave, during which we were given a sum of money to buy our uniforms, which we did. I went to Savile Row to a naval tailor and kitted out in a few days. And then we had to report to Royal Naval College Greenwich for our 2-week etiquette knife and fork course. You've heard that before, yes.
What did that entail?
2 weeks. Learning how to eat decorously in the painted hall with Wren stewardesses ticking us off if we did anything wrong. And we were allowed to bring a guest on a particular banqueting night, which was very, very pleasant. And when we weren't learning how to use a knife and fork, we were taught unarmed combat and naval history, all in 2 weeks.
Seems a really strange mix of things. How were you taught unarmed combat?
Well, there was this elderly naval lieutenant, and he told us what a disadvantage it was for anybody to for the person to attack you with a bayonet, because she could turn it on him. I never tried it.
Where were you posted to next?
Yes, we were sent on a short leave, and then I was posted to RNAS East Haven, which is near the famous Carnoustie Golf Course near Dundee in Scotland.
And what was the purpose of this?
It was a station where new pilots learned to fly with crews, and so it was quite essential that they met some observers and air gunners and learnt to fly with a crew, because up to then they'd only done their flying training as pilots by themselves or with an instructor. There we had... I was introduced to the fairy swordfish.
Can you give me a kind of thumbnail sketch of the swordfish?
Yes. First of all, we were in Trinidad, where we could have done with an open cockpit swordfish because of the heat, but we used to fly largely in albacores, which were very hot because they cabin aeroplanes with perspex all around them. But when we got to East Haven, flying over the North Sea in an open cockpit, that was quite a rude shock. And then we learnt how to dress ourselves in many layers of clothing, even in the late spring.
What would that layers of clothing entail? What would you actually wear?
Well, first of all, you wear some good underclothes, warm underclothes. Then you have this one piece, what they call a Sidcut suit, which is a zip-up one-piece suit. And then, if you're lucky enough to have a flying jacket, you wore that. White silk gloves, and then leather gauntlets, fur-lined flying boots, helmet and goggles. Took quite a long time to dress up. And then you had to navigate with all this clobber on.
How easy is that?
Well, so long as you're prepared, it's not too bad. You learn the hard way to clip your chart onto your chart board with bulldog clips continuously all the way around. Otherwise the wind would get underneath it and whip your chart off, which is rather embarrassing if you're a navigator. Also, you mustn't drop anything because there's no room to bend down and pick it up. And so all your pencils, dividers, and everything you need for navigating has got to be tied to your person with a piece of string. And then, fortunately, it wasn't in the middle of winter, so I did have a bit of feeling in my fingers. But it's not easy to navigate on a chart with two pairs of gloves on.
Would you take the glove off at all?
Yes, you could probably work with your silk gloves, yes. But then you've got to be careful what you do with your glove if you take it off.
And how did you communicate with the pilot?
The voice pipe, a flexible voice pipe. You just shout through this tube. It's like a rubber tube connecting to the pilot.
Does he have...
Yes, it's connected to his helmet.
And do you shout into it?
You shout into it, yes.
I imagine weather conditions, even in springtime in Scotland, were very different from what you've been doing in Trinidad.
My golly, yes. It's quite cold, of course, especially if you're navigating over the North Sea. It was never warm up there over the sea, and it's the wind though. It's the slipstream mainly. But I know it's only about 90 knots in a swordfish, but the aircraft is designed so that the pilot has a tiny windscreen in front, and behind him the wind whips down into the cockpit from both sides, so it's a permanent gale blowing in the back cockpit.
Was there problems with poor weather or navigating in poor weather? Because obviously in Trinidad you probably had much nicer weather, didn't you?
Most of the time, yes.
Because in Scotland I would assume you would have much more clouds and...
Yes. We did a few navigation exercises, but mostly we didn't go very far afield because we were more or less crew training. So we only did a few navigation exercises. I did one journey. It was also a deck landing training school run by Lieutenant Commander Everett, who was the batting king. And he was the chap who trained most of the batsmen. And he said to me one day, "You're coming with me, my observer, but you've got to go on HMS Illustrious. I've got to train some new batsmen." So I went. He didn't need me, really. He knew the way to the Clyde. So we went there, and we steamed up and down, went in the swordfish, landed on the carrier, and they were just equipped with barracudas and seafires, all getting very modern. And so I had a pleasant three or four days on this big carrier with nothing particular to do while he was training some new batsmen.
What was your first experience then of landing on a carrier like?
It was just a very short, hard landing. Nothing very much, because he was very good, of course, to Commander Everett. He'd done it probably more times than anybody else. And so he made an extremely good landing. And, of course, with a swordfish, the landing approach is so slow that it's not difficult to make a good landing in the swordfish in good conditions.
How long were you at Easthaven then?
About 6 weeks. And then we were sent a short distance up the coast to Arbroath to do a two-week astro-navigation course for some unknown reason.
Can you tell me about astro-navigation?
We had these special sextants for use in aircraft, because the thing about a sextant is that you've got to hold it very, very steady, and there's a bubble in the middle of the eyepiece, and you've got to have your star or whatever celestial object you're taking a sight of in the middle of this bubble. And so if you're in a rather bumpy aircraft, it's not easy to keep this in the middle of the bubble, and you can't do it very accurately. So they worked out a system with this, I think it was called a Mark 12 sextant, which had a clockwork apparatus in it. You wound it up, and it would take 12, I think, sights every few seconds. It would take a sight every few seconds, and then it would average it out. So you would try to keep the object in the middle of the bubble, in the middle of the eyepiece. And the idea was that if you tried it 12 times and took the average, you'd be fairly accurate. But it wasn't easy to do it. And we had to take some sights on the ground, of course, for practice, and then we were sent up in a swordfish, of all things, in the back of a swordfish. And in actual fact, I never took a sun sight from the swordfish, because it was a very cloudy day and the swordfish couldn't get above the cloud. So after struggling for about half an hour, the pilot gave up and came down again.
And was that 2 weeks that was purely dealing with astro-navigation, was it?
That's right. They had this strange idea that this new Grumman Avenger, which we were going to be sent to form a squadron with, it was very long range. And of course that was just the American sales talk.
So what happened to you next after that course?
Yeah, we were given a rail warrant to go up to the... After leave, we were given a rail warrant to go to the Clyde, where we joined our next ship to take passage, which was the Queen Mary, which went across in, I think, 4.5 days, or what 3.5.
What were conditions like on board the Queen Mary?
Well, very good, because it was fairly empty. Fellow passengers included Winston Churchill, most of the chiefs of staff, Guy Gibson, the Gedam Buster, and a few selected people, and a few assorted people like us taking passage. So it was a very, very pleasant journey.
Did you see Winston Churchill when you were going across at all?
Oh, yes, certainly. He used to see him with his cigar, taking his constitutional round the deck. The ship only went to Halifax because he was going to attend the Quebec conference. And so from Halifax we went down back to down to New York, and then we waited in New York, then we were sent to a little airfield in Maine. I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's a small airfield in the middle of Maine where we were waiting, because in the services you spend a lot of your life waiting. And then we were waiting for a vacancy in Boston where they were forming up one Avenger Squadron a month, and we were just waiting as a pool of observers and pilots and air gunners in this other small airfield.
Were you aware that you were going to be in flying the Grumman Avenger?
Yes, we knew we were being sent over to form a Grumman Avenger squadron. So eventually we were sent down to US Naval Air Station in Squantum, just outside Boston, where we met all our future squadron mates and our new CO, the famous Bobby Bradshaw, who was one of the best known and best decorated naval aviators in the war. And we were immediately impressed by him. Young, good looking, 23-year-old, already with a DSC and bar and a mention in dispatches, and a very, very nice chap. And we all immediately became on Christian name terms. I was Bill, he was Bobby, and everything went on marvellously, and we had a most marvellous experience with him.
When you form a squadron like that, do you form it with your ground crew as well? Is that,
oh, certainly.
Part of the thing?
Yes, that's all part of it. Altogether, there must have been about 120 of us, air crew and ground crew.
And that ground crew stays with the squadron, does it?
Oh, certainly. And each aircraft has its own little nucleus of engine fitter, radar fitter, armourer, etc., rigger, all look after that particular aeroplane, because they've got the responsibility for that aeroplane.
And is it important to be on good relations with your ground crew?
Oh, certainly, very much so. And it works the other way as well. If the if you're having a bit of trouble with particularly the engine, and the engine mechanic assures the pilot that it's all right, the pilot then invites him to go on a test flight with him.
Did you crew up at this stage then?
Yes.
Who was your crew?
Pete Westover, a tall, gangly chap. Most of the pilots were straight off training. The only experienced pilots who'd had any previous experience were the CO and the senior pilot. And all the others were green.
Had they trained in America, most of them?
Well, all of them are trained in America because they were able to get them from close by then. As I say, all except the CO and the senior pilot were inexperienced and pretty well straight off training, almost straight off training.
Did you have a team of British air gunner as well?
Oh, yes, a crew of three. Of those, I think only two had been experienced, the chief air gunner, who was quite old, he was in his late 20s. The senior observer was in his late 20s too, we thought he was old also.
Can you describe to me the sort of interior of the Grumman Avenger, where everybody is within the aircraft?
Yes, it was very comfortable, though from our point of view, rather strangely planned, because the British Fleet Air Arm worked with a crew of three on their bomber aircraft, a pilot, observer and air gunner. And the air gunner was also the radio operator, the observer would be the radar operator. But the Americans made the pilot do everything, and the two crewmen, as they called them, in the back were just gunner radio. And so, although there were a crew of three, the pilot not only had to fly the aeroplane, but had to do the navigating also, which was rather a lot to put him. And consequently, The navigation in the American naval aviation wasn't all that good. I mean, they relied more on navigational aids simply because they gave the pilot too much work. Consequently, although there was a space behind the pilot, ample space for a crew member, it was left empty. And the two crew members sat in the back where they couldn't see anything, just had two little portholes at the side. And they did have a power-operated turret with one gun, which was very, very difficult to get in and out of, and wasn't a lot of use, really. And once you were in there, you were more or less imprisoned in there. And it was rather a peculiar situation. So very quickly, we set up the observer just behind the pilot in the centre section, where he had a very, very good view. It was quite roomy. Moved the radar set in there from the back and put a little navigation table, and he had an ideal situation, because if he'd been in the back, his visibility was almost nil. So we modified the American aircraft to our purposes.
Was there just the turret gun, or was there any other?
There was a rear-facing belly gun facing aft, yes. I don't know if it was ever used, because to man it, you had to lie on your stomach, facing aft, viewing through a little Perspex window about this size, very little traverse, and it was only a 0.3 anyway. So I think it was more of a morale gun, and the Japanese were probably warned not to attack from the rear because there was a belly gun.
And would that be your job as an observer to man that gun? Or would that
No, because I would have been in the centre section.
And there was no... Could you communicate with the two?
Yes, there was a tunnel which you could wriggle through if you took all your outer clothing and parachute harness off. And so it wasn't practical, really, to try and go to between the back and the front.
How did you go forming up the squadron? What was the kind of things, activities that you would do to get to gel as a squadron?
Mm. Well, we were given 3 months to form up. And in that time, the pilots, who I think all of them has had experience in the Grumman Avenger, we'd never seen a Grumman Avenger before, but then it wasn't so important for us because we didn't have the instrumentation and performance of the aeroplane to worry about. The air gunners had a ball because they, for a change, they had a decent radio set with press button wave change in 1943. He used to press a button and watch all these little things turning and set themselves on the frequency required. So they really liked it, and of course they liked their power-operated turret as well. And everybody was quite happy. The pilots liked the aeroplane, and it was a very, very good aeroplane. There's no doubt about that.